Welcome to Extraneous.
Welcome to Extraneous.
Fresh for 2020.
Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year. Thank you for being patient with us as we had some schedule bloop, bloop, bloops during the holiday, but we're back.
And man, we have a cool show today.
We do. And we'll get to that in a second. In the meantime, you are listening to a Mischief Media podcast.
That's right. Go to mischiefmedia.com to check out all the podcasts, yep, including Make New Mistakes, which is starting to introduce the Mischief team. And yes, it is fascinating. All of them such interesting and compelling people with amazing experience. I can vouch for this. So definitely check that out.
We're still doing some wrap up on the series. We'll explain that in a second. In either next week or the week after, we are going to go back to the books. We're so excited.
Yes.
Back to our Subtle Knife. Well, we're starting Subtle Knife. Mm-hmm. So stick around for that. We're going to do some more talking about the series, what worked, what didn't work.
More guests may be coming. We're in conversation, so stay tuned for that.
There are also some spoilers for the series overall in this conversation.
The book series.
So once again, leave your job, leave your family, read the books. I don't know how many times I have to tell you this.
Listen, just do it and we'll stop bugging you about it.
Yeah, it's fine.
By the way, congratulations to John Williams, who has managed to secure an Oscar nomination despite all the complications
for being in our basement
for being in our basement. Yeah, he doesn't have any best podcast theme awards.
You are correct. That is true.
He has zero.
All right. So, Will.
Yeah.
Hello, Will.
Hello, Melissa.
We have a guest tonight.
We do.
Today.
Now.
Whatever part of the day it is when you're listening to this podcast. It's the beauty of the podcasty thing.
We do. And we're so excited to have her on the pod.
This person has been a friend of ours for quite some time. She's a Hollywood writer. I'm just going to read off her bio because it did it so succinctly. She's a Hollywood writer covering TV and film for VanityFair.com. She also hosts a bunch of podcasts. Yeah. Her podcasts include A Cast of Kings, Storm of Spoilers, and The Station Agents. She lives in Northern California, and she knows more about Game of Thrones than either of us, which is very, very, very true.
That's for sure.
I don't know if you guessed by now, but we're welcoming our friend Joanna Robinson.
Joanna Robinson.
Hello. You guys, I'm so excited to be here. There are a few things I love more than talking about rich fantasy world books that have been adapted into a prestige HBO television show.
So, Joanna, we would love to ask you, before we get into the series itself, tell us a little bit about how you kind of got into the world of His Dark Materials.
Yeah, like most things, you know, that I experienced as a kid, I picked these up from my sister, my older sister, who was reading the Philip Pullman books. And is that a trend?
My sister is why my whole career exists. She got me into Rent. She got me into Harry Potter. The younger sister's like secondary goal of seeming cool to the older sister, I maintain, is responsible for some of the biggest things.
Yeah, I used to go like shopping in her room. I would just like go in her room and go and sit in front of her bookcase and be like, what are these books? They look interesting. Anyway, so she definitely read these books before I did. Well, the first one came out in like, what, 95, I think, right? So I was in like eighth grade, but I think I was in like a high school, I think, when I read these.
Yeah, because so they came out in 95 in the UK, and I think it was 96, 97 here.
Got it. Yeah, we had to wait a little bit. So yeah, I was in high school when I read him the first time, and then I started to do this thing. There's this, I'm sure you're familiar, there's this full cast recording audiobook version.
Yeah.
And I got it at some point in, I think, college, and probably got it on CD, but it might have even been tape. But let's just like pretend it was a CD. And I would just listen to it like over and over again, the full cast recording, because it was so perfectly and beautifully done. So that's my experience with the book series. And then I tried to read some of Philip Pullman's other books with like mixed results. But it's really this core trilogy. I mean, I know he's continuing. I know there are two more books, but it's really the core trilogy that have really stuck with me. So
I've never read Ruby and the Smoke.
Yeah. I mean, they're the Sally Lockhart books are kind of fun. But they're not, I don't feel them as deeply as I feel these books.
No.
And and I think that these books, and then I became a bookseller out of college. I was a bookseller for like a decade. My favorite trick I ever pulled as a bookseller is like a mom came in furious because we had sold some books to her young daughter. And I want to say they were like the Tamara Pierce Alana books, I think, mm-hmm. or something like that. Something that she felt was like too sexually explicit for her daughter. And I was like, well, you should read these Philip Pullman books. And I sold her on them and she bought them. And my coworkers are like, did you just sell that lady? Like, well, I don't want to spoil. I don't know if you're like, if you spoil things that happen in the later books or...
We do when we're not doing an episode review.
Okay. So, my coworker's like, did you just sell her the books about people trying to kill God? That lady was like upset. And I was like, oh, I sure did. So, so that happened. And then, I remember when the movie came out, the one and only movie, mm-hmm. feature film, and I was so excited about it that I got all my friends together and we dressed up. The premiere, there were like a bunch of armored bears. There was like a Mrs. Coulter, my friend, dressed up as Lee Scoresby. It was like this whole thing. We were definitely the only people at the theater dress up, but we were just like, we were really there for it. And and obviously, like the movie was not what people wanted, not what I wanted. But there, yeah. I still like. I think I feel more positively towards it than most people just because I'm like determined to find the things I love in it, if that makes sense. And that's how I feel about this series that's currently happening at HBO, is that like I feel like it got off to a bumpy start, but I'm really glad that I and some other people I know stuck with it, because I think it just got like better and better as it progressed. And there's a lot that they gave me that I wanted, enough that it smooths over the things they didn't land, as far as I'm concerned, if that makes sense. So, yeah.
Yeah, totally.
That's my full history. Did I do it all?
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. Who did you dress up as?
I was an armored bear, and it was really amazing. Fun. Cool. Like, we did, like, ears. We, like, cut – I feel bad about it, but we, like, cut ears off of these, like, white teddy bears and, like, put them on our heads and then, like, made armor out of, like, tinfoil and colanders and stuff like that. It was really fun.
That's amazing.
So I know that you guys love the books, but I don't know if I know, like, how you're feeling at the end of it all, at the end of this season of television.
Will and I differ.
Okay. We do a little bit, yeah.
I'm the glass half full.
Okay.
Where this is concerned, I'm really mad about some things. There are some things that they did that I was like, there's no excuse. There's no excuse for this. But overall, I'm really glad that it's a well-acted, beautiful rendition. And I have hope, based on the finale,
right.
I have hopes for it. I see them say things like, oh boy, we can't do Subtle Knife in 8 episodes. I mean, we can't do Amber Spyglass in 8 episodes. That's impossible. And you think, yes. And then they say, we need 10. And it's like, oh, that's, you need like 20. You need like 20. I don't know what, but, like, we could tell you going through trying the first episode of this podcast, we tried to do 5 chapters. That was folly.
That's a lot of what this series was sort of suffering under in the first half, mm-hmm. 2/3 maybe, is like so much exposition and world building that it has to get through. And that's, I think, the thing it handled the least well. And then, but as you say, Melissa, the performances, like just, I was mm-hmm. rewatching the finale before we were recording, and just the use of James McAvoy and Ruth Wilson as Mrs. Uh-huh. Coulter and Azrael, and like, this moment when they find these two like incredible performers finally meet and share screen time is so powerful that I'm like, oh, I could just forgive so much because they gave me this. And as you say, right? Like, it makes me excited for season 2. I'm just sort of like, this can only get stronger. And then I hope it'll just get stronger and stronger. And then we'll look back and we'll be like, oh yeah, season 1 wasn't great. But remember season 1 of Buffy? Right. It wasn't that great. Right. They're figuring
right.
it out.
Yeah. Thing. They need to trust them a little bit. They need to give them money for demons. I'm so, so, so hopeful that they get to the end of 3, because spoiler alert, I mean, again, we say this every time, if you haven't read the books, stop everything you're doing, leave your families.
Yeah, quit your job, leave your family, read the books.
Go read the books.
Yeah.
But spoiler alert, like, Mrs. Coulter and Azrael jump on Metatron and drag him down into the abyss forever. That scene with the two of them, I'm so down. If we don't get there, it'll be such a disaster.
Will, you know. Will, what's your glass?
Yeah, sorry.
What's your glass half empty take?
So I want to preface this by saying that I philosophically agree with your approach that to take a bunch of little things that you like about the show, because it is such an incredibly rich world, and So it's like every episode is a new opportunity to see so many amazing things that you've just seen in your head for so long by reading the books.
Right.
So that's cool. And so I remain optimistic, at least about having future like moments of wonder. But in general, I wasn't super convinced by the series. I thought too many big moments, they didn't handle well enough. They kind of stuck between not telling this particular story well enough by not having like the armor on the bears or really committing to the human demon relationship, like setting aside those specifics and just looking at making this just a compelling like coming of age action story. Mm-hmm. I felt like they were kind of stuck between those two things and they didn't necessarily achieve it totally successfully.
I think I agree with you that I think the biggest failing is that human demon relationship thing, which I think a lot of people have pointed out, but it's just like, it's frustrating, but maybe also I am so beaten down by the lack of direwolves on Game of Thrones that I'm like,
I wanted to kind of like poke you on that a little bit because you spent so much of your life really in depth covering Game of Thrones between your podcasts and Vanity Fair, and everybody wants something to be the next Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of like, is this the next Game of Thrones? Or is this not the Game of Thrones? So how did that experience of going through that series affect your viewing of this one?
The end of Game of Thrones was so fraught with just sort of like people's expectations and what all happened that I almost wish this series were premiering now, like just a fresh start 2020, and I could devote like all of my thought and attention to it. But I think the end of 2019, I was so like kind of burnt out on all the, you know, and it was like Star Wars was happening and Watchmen was happening and I just and Mandalorian was happening, and I just felt overloaded by these like big things rushing in to try to fill that Thrones vacuum that it makes me sad, because like this is a fact of HBO, which is that, you know, they used to roll things out at a slower pace. They only put things out on Sunday nights, and, you know, like everything felt special. Since their merger with AT&T, the mandate is to up the output of programming. I swear this is not just dry insider baseball, but like,
this is really interesting.
Well, their mandate is to double, if not more so, the output of programming. And that tends to make everything just feel less special. Everything's just going at a breakneck. Mm-hmm. So you're not able to just sort of like take your time with something. Plus there's all these other things competing for space. And so I have been of the mindset for a while that there will never be another Game of Thrones, because we just don't live in that environment anymore where something has the oxygen to be that special. And so it's so crowded now. Maybe if we finally reach a breaking point and then things calm down content wise, but in this like binge culture, like heavy churn of entertainment, it's hard for me to imagine. And I would just have preferred more time and more space to be able to devote to this and to do like very close reading comparisons of the book and the show and the way it fell short and the way that it really landed some things. But I do think that Thrones, the way in which I had heard the very smart people and the very good people who've worked on Game of Thrones for years talk about the things that they couldn't do, I was sort of pre-prepared for the demons to not. I mean, when I saw, I think I told you this, Melissa, but when I saw the first episode, they gave us like a work in progress version, and the demons were all still like not
puppets?
Finished at all.
Really?
Yeah. And I was like, oh, it was not like they weren't like puppets, but they were like just blocky, you know, that sort of like pre-viz sort of blocky CG. So then by comparison, almost, I was like, wow, they look great. And they look great. But it's just sort of like, but the character of Pan is just not a character, you know, is not as much of a character as he needs to be. I was rewatching some stuff, as I mentioned, and there's the part where, you know, Mrs. Coulter interrupts Lyra possibly being separated forever from Pan, and Lyra walks out of the cage and she like goes to stare at Mrs. Coulter, and I'm like, why is Pan not in her arms immediately, shivering and close and like that? I was like, that's so important. And so like there are moments when they almost do it, and then, you know, like when you see Mrs. Coulter's monkey and Stelmaria sort of like nuzzling each other in the finale, and that's just sort of like in the foreground, and that's a wordless image that mm-hmm. is so meaningful, but does it land yep. meaningfully for people who are only watching the show and don't know the book?
You can easily be forgiven if you've never read the books for thinking that in this world, some people have these pets they carry around with them
right.
and some people don't. Like, that's like a VFX. There's budget. There's all these reasons. But the effect, no matter what the reason, the impact versus intent, the effect is that it doesn't feel like a precious, sacred thing. And so when this big threat comes that they're taking demons away from the children, it just feels like they're killing children.
Right.
It feels like devoid of the very unique thing at the core of the series.
Honestly, it's interesting, Joanna, to hear you talk about hearing for so many years that Game of Thrones producers were kind of saying the same thing, because I was struck when I started reading about the series as we were watching it of like how much explanation I felt like we were getting compared to what I was used to for like a creator creates something and puts it out in the world and then they kind of shut up. But there was a lot of like, oh, we couldn't do this scene because of VFX people. We couldn't do this scene because of child labor laws. So we couldn't, mm-hmm. you know, shoot with the characters as much as we wanted. And there was just, it seemed like every episode we got a lot of this insider baseball from the writer and from the producers.
Yeah.
And I wonder if partly that's just how these TV shows work. And Joanna, you've kind of been in the middle of those discussions with Thrones for so long. But also I wonder, with that shifting culture at HBO, if a lot of these folks kind of signed on to do one sort of series and then found the culture was a little bit different at HBO and like the demands were different than they were kind of expecting.
Well, that's partially true, but it's also, right, a co-production with BBC, and so you're working with, like, BBC people, BBC budget is part of it. I don't know exactly how the money was flowing precisely, but, you know, this is, like, extremely high-end for a BBC production, you know, which have only been looking better and better as the years have gone on. But, like, for me, it feels more like the HBO thing is affecting rollout and timing and mm-hmm. depth and all this sort of stuff, but also they felt they seemed pressed, like they seemed pressed yeah. to get it out, you know, whereas I'm just like, you know, if they didn't have an episode available for us to watch in August, a single episode available for us to watch, like that made me nervous about like where they were production wise and stuff like that.
That's an interesting perspective. You're used to about 2 months out, that being like, yeah, that's this thing is wrapped and in the can and not being in this tight. Do you think it's because the BBC is used to ending series around Christmas?
Honestly, I think a lot of the HBO stuff, I don't know about the BBC timeline, but I think the HBO stuff, a lot of that, they're on an accelerated, let's get it out sort of thing. So I don't know who was driving what the release date would be for this particular project. I just know that it's just seems like a lot less controlled, measured, considered release of properties.
It's worth mentioning also that the writer, Jack Thorne,
yeah.
had like five different projects. Like he's doing Secret Garden, and he did Aeronauts, and he did this, and he did The Christmas Carol, kind of all at once. So I wonder if that also affected, he just had such a tight schedule.
Right. I also don't know how Jack Thorne got the kingdom, like the keys of the kingdom. Like, yeah. you know,
right?
I don't know how your Potter community feels about Chris Child, but like, yeah, like the kids that I've talked to, like I work with middle schoolers sometimes, and they hate Chris Child, which is really funny to me, because like I know a lot of adults who liked it, but I'm like, oh, the children are mad. So I was just like, you know, that's sort of like how, you know, and like Chris Child is a huge, like it's a huge success. It's a huge stage success, you know, and it, like I think the truth is like once you show that you can make money off a property, whether or not that thing is actually like great, if you can make money mm-hmm. off of it, then you get the keys to more kingdoms. And so, but when I saw yeah. that it was Jack Thorne on this, I was like, oh, I don't know how, I don't know if I believe that he understands what makes these various book series as special as they are to people. That's my take on Chris Child. I think it's got really cool stagecraft, yep. but I don't feel like watching right. it, I'm watching the work of someone who really understands this story and why it's so powerful. And I feel similarly to this, like, honestly, if this show weren't cast so well, it would be a real miss for me. But I think, yep. you know, we already mentioned James McAvoy, Ruth Wilson. I love Daphne Keene as Lyra. And so when things are rushed or things like, okay, so are we going to talk about like, can we talk about some big moments? So like Billy Costa, it's really interesting yeah. because like, does the whole depiction of Billy Costa work? That right. being said, Anne-Marie Duff is so good as Ma Costa. Ma Costa is yep. not mm-hmm. really at all how I think of her in the book. But nope. Anne-Marie Duff is so good
yep.
that I just like did feel her grief. So
totally.
Like
yes.
things didn't work, but then her grief does. Her grief works throughout. She's so powerful. And so
I have a number of questions
yeah,
about this.
Hit me. Hit
tell me.
Me
if you agree.
Yeah.
Why did they take Billy Costa's demon away when he was clearly much younger than everybody else?
Great
in
question.
The room.
Right. He like, yeah, he looks 6 years old.
Yeah. He looks 6 years old. Right. So there's that. And they did it because he was cute. He paid a cute tax. He did it. They did it because he was cutie cutie. I agree with you about Ma Costa. I think of her as Mrs. Weasley. She's a plump, disheveled
yeah. right.
woman to me in my head.
Yeah. An earth mother and like sort of thing. Yeah. Yeah.
yeah. yeah. Yeah. A little scary.
Right.
You know, like yeah. that's Lyra's yeah. first thing she says about her is she's scared of her because she'd beaten her once, but given her hot chocolate.
Yeah.
like or like slapped her twice and hugged her once or something like that. Like that's
right.
yeah. you know. And yeah, the and this is where we get into the human demon relationship. There is just no way at all, first of all, that okay, wait, I have two things here. One of the things is that they made it really hard for us to make excuses for them when they explained Billy Costa dying not as he's without his demon and he expired because that's how horrific it is, but as he was wandering around in the cold. Like
yeah.
whether
yeah.
that was the intent of the script, that was like the flavor of the script, you yeah. know? And then you cannot convince me, not at all, that Mrs. Costa's demon would not be on her lap in that moment
yeah.
or like with her yeah. son. And so I know budget, but like make yeah. the choices where you make them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So that's where I am.
Yeah. I mean, hire a falconer or something
yeah.
to like have their falcon sit on like a ledge behind her or something.
Yeah.
Like it seems like there are non-expensive, I could be wrong, but it seems like there are creative ways around the budget restrictions for some of these scenes yeah. like that.
Yeah. Add some puppies in there.
I also, yeah, like would you be less offended by them changing a demon to something more budget friendly if it meant that demon were around more?
Way less offended.
Yeah, yeah. I think so too. Yeah. yeah.
If the world felt like these animals are everywhere and then as a result, you know that they're an indispensable part of the fabric, I would forgive them being actual animals as opposed to CGI.
Yeah.
All of the time.
And that's how I felt, you know, to go back to Game of Thrones, that's how I always yeah. felt about the direwolves. They're like, well, the problem was, like, they're big and they look weird and blah, blah, blah. I was like, why didn't you just make them wolf size? If you just yeah. made them,
right.
like,
yeah.
husky dogs,
fine.
Honestly, it would have yeah. been fine. Like, really, yeah. honestly. So
the ones we met at Con of Thrones were perfectly
yes.
suitable to the task.
They yeah. were lovely. They were. So that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about where a performance can allow me to smooth some things over. I'm like, okay, but emotionally they're still getting me there. It's all because of Anne-Marie Duff, but they are getting mm-hmm. me there. You know what I mean? And so then that moment where like the Egyptians are singing and like everything, I was like, this is beautiful television.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So once again, that's just down to casting. I do want to talk about, I don't mean to hop around too much, but I do want to talk about Lin-Manuel Miranda because
yeah.
Here's the deal with yes. Lin. Like, Lin was the person I was most skeptical about in this cast because, like, I already knew, like, Ruth Wilson and James McAvoy and, like, all those people can just, like, act circles around anyone. Lin, I don't think of as, you know, I know you guys mm-mm. are, like, Broadway folk. I love Lin's, like, work in the theater. But I gotta say, like, this is actually one of my favorite Lin-Manuel Miranda's performance. It has nothing to do with any idea of Lee Scoresby at all. Like, I'm just like, if I just pretend it's not Lee Scoresby, I'm not mad about it. You know what I mean? I'm just sort of like, okay, I mean, like, you could never cast it better than Sam Elliott if we're being real. Like, Sam Elliott, in my mind, is the perfect Lee Scoresby. Like, you know, and so, like, then I just had to like let go of it. And in letting go of it, I was just like, it's this other aeronaut that swooped in and is fine, you know? So.
Yeah. And I mean, he's completely different. He's like a grifter. He
yeah.
like
yeah.
pickpockets people. He does things that Lee Scoresby would never really
yeah,
do.
He has moments of laziness, which that's just like not the least Scoresby we know.
Yeah.
A little bit of problematic choices for him, you know, when you make sure it's a Latinx character, that's really cool. But then when you change the character to make that person a bit of a grifter, not so cool and not so great anymore. And also, like, Lynn, I was going with it. I loved it. And then they gave him these, like, clunkers of lines in the last couple of episodes.
Yeah.
They were like, the sideswipe me with love line and the weird interaction with him and Serafina Pecola in the snow. Yeah. I don't think he was served well. I think he's a very suitable performer and he's a suitable singer. And like you said, I agree with everything you said there. And with the right role, like in Mary Poppins, he was great. He was fun and hammy. And that's sort of what Lynn has to be that's the pocket of his performing talent.
Right.
And instead these, you know, they were trying to make him make subtlety out of these really, really unsubtle lines. And that's not his pocket. Ruth Wilson could do it.
I agree. I think the Lynn of the first couple episodes that we see him, I thought was really cool. He's someone who I'd almost want to watch a whole series about, separate from HDM, of like
the Scoresby, the
where
series.
He
like
came
a,
from.
A prequel, a Scoresby prequel.
Yeah.
Yeah, like a Scoresby prequel.
So Disney Plus style where you have like Kenobi, but yeah, you have Scoresby.
Right.
I'd watch that.
Yeah.
Totally. The writing for him towards the end was just really...
Yeah, I think that's true.
It was like... Yeah, every line of his read like a Lynn good morning tweet, you know, where it's like, good morning, you're great. The world is beautiful. Wow. Good luck out there. And I don't
or
know.
Like a
I
noir
found it a
little
film. Cringy.
Like, you know.
Yeah, like somewhere in between, like a noir film from someone who had never actually seen a noir film and just like heard of them.
Get the getaway sticks on that kid.
I've heard a rumor that there's something called noir and like... I thought maybe I'd put noir and like a rake together and see like right. like yeah. a rogue character and see how that works out. Yeah. I didn't read the His Dark Materials books though. Should I have read those? Is there a character named Lee Scoresby in them? Anyway, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. That's the Lynn of it all as far as I'm concerned. I think you're right. It does like have a really bad downward turn towards the end of the season. Another performer that I want to shout out is James Cosmo, speaking of Game of Thrones as Fata Coram. Like, that's a character that, you know, I care about in the books, but they really sort of gave him a lot of, like, room to stretch his legs in the series. And I think he made really good use of all of his time. And his scene with Serafina Pecola, like, that initial sort of interaction, that just, like... floored me. I thought it was so good. So, you know, just these moments, and you know, you might have read this in one of the interviews you've been reading, Will, but that might be one of those like child labor law things where like I'm currently doing a podcast about my so-called life, and one of the things that's true about my so-called life, we're almost done because there's only like 19 episodes, is Claire Danes was too young, you know, to be in every scene of the series.
Right.
And so you get all this stuff with Angela's parents on this show that's like ostensibly about a teenage girl, but you got a lot of stuff about Angela's parents. And when you're a teen watching that show, you're like, yawn, oh my God, we're back to Angela's parents. I don't want to do this. And then when you watch an adult, you're like, oh, this is very good adult drama. I like this a lot. You know what I mean? But it's something they had to do because they had this teen actress. Uh-huh. And so like, I feel like some of this like Fata Coram stuff or other stuff is there because they're trying to fill out the episode when they can't use the kids. So
yep, something that you said that like Will always says, which is, how did Jack Thorne get the keys to the kingdom? Because it does seem like he did Harry Potter, and then suddenly
everything.
He's being given every
important children's story. Well, yeah, Joanna may have gotten it right that he shows that these can be money making properties again. I think one thing might be, Jack Thorne will give you a script. I remember looking up his resume, and it seems like he's churned out like between 2 and 5 works a year for like the past like 7, 8, 9 years.
He's
like,
prolific.
He has like 5 or 6 radio plays. Yeah, he has like 2 plays a year. He's done like 6 movies. He's done a ton of TV.
Right.
Like, he's someone who you can give 5 projects and a deadline to, I get the sense, and you will get something workable back. If you're like
a
studio exec, who's like, I need content.
Yeah.
There's like some freelancer's credo where it's like, you know, turning in on time is better than like turning it in great or something like that, which I don't, I mean,
absolutely.
It's not how I live my life, but I think it is a way to live life successfully.
Oh, so, I feel that's, you know, so hard. I'm like, yeah, that's good advice for everybody.
If you want to be a Jack Thorne, like, sure.
And then, like, run a company.
If you want to like have a bunch of, so Will, Mr. Material. I'm curious what you, yeah, or you, Will, and also Will, in our story, I'm curious what you guys think of this, of decision to bring Will in, the way they brought him in.
I think it's a really good idea to bring him in because we've talked about this on earlier episodes a little bit. It would be a little jarring to introduce him in like episode one of season two, especially because he has to end up at the same place Lyra is at the same time.
Right.
So to have him just kind of show up there or get like a quick one episode intro would be a little disorienting. Like, I think the opening of Subtle Knife is so well written that it kind of captures you, but it is a little confusing for the first few chapters because you're like, where's Lyra? What's going on?
Right.
Who is this new person?
Right.
I felt like they could have brought him in a little bit later because I thought his introduction was really strong, and then there were a couple episodes where he didn't really have much to do because he had a destination to get to, but he had time to kill.
Yeah.
And I thought switching to like 30 seconds of Will not really doing anything or having like another discussion with, or like Boreal having another discussion with Will's mom and then going back to the car and talking to his henchmen and then going back to his mom was a little bit disorienting and kind of broke up the flow of the episodes and the other storylines. So I thought it was a good idea. I thought it could have been executed a little more tightly, I guess.
I completely agree. I think if you brought him in, like, even episode five, I love his introduction. And, like, you meet him and the way that he's taking care of his mom and you're just immediately on this kid's side and you just, like, want to protect him and take care of him. I think the casting of Andrew Scott is really exciting and brilliant.
And the
use of him, like, even just, like, Will watching that interview with him and then just, like, that interview is just sort of, like, playing in the background and stuff like that, like, mm-hmm, that's very powerful. But I agree with you, there's just like, and I like Boreal and I like him like sort of creeping around, and I thought it was, I was shocked because he goes to Will's World in episode two and I was like, oh yeah, we're already here, oh my gosh,
yeah.
But like, I completely agree that we could have introduced that later, and I don't think it would have, you know, I wonder if they were worried that it would slow down the momentum of like Lyra's nearing Bullvanger and Lyra's doing this and right, Lyra's doing that, to put the Will stuff there. But I think you're right. Stretching it did it no favors. I agree.
They're also maybe making a problem for themselves in how much they've amped up Boreal's character. Like,
that's true.
He, you know, they've made him such a bigger character in the books, which I'm like, I'm here for. But we don't know what his ultimate goal is. We don't know why he's so interested in it outside of that one argument he gave Facebook Retreat Guy about, like, we call his buddy Facebook Retreat Guy because of that cabin.
I love it.
In the woods.
Yeah, it's like the woods cabin with all the tech.
With all the tech, you know?
It's totally a tech bro retreat.
Tech bro retreat type. Guy. And so, like, he gave, you know, so we don't really, like, know what he's after. And too much time with a character whose stakes you don't feel can be hard. You know, so then if they just drop him in season two because he's served his purpose, I might be kind of okay with that. But they might be like setting up a very hard like math equation to solve about what is Boreal's wider importance.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
He's so compellingly portrayed and looks so great and the snake demon and like all this sort of stuff like that. And he starts strong by like killing that poor reporter who's just doing her job and all this sort of stuff like that, you know, but like, so he's so creepy and he's so great. But yeah, I think all the Magisterium stuff feels really murky, especially I think people who are unfamiliar with the books are very confused about like the Magisterium and like what it is and what it wants and the different factions within it and you know, what Asriel's rebellion is versus what Mrs. Coulter wants versus, you know, whatever. So that's something that I've had to try to like explain to people over and over again, so I know for a fact it's confusing. So that's
you've been like watching it with people who've never read the books and they've been having those sorts of questions.
Yeah. And they're like, that seems to be the main confusion. Cause like demons you can kind of get pretty quickly. Like
sure.
Egyptians you get, like people snatching children. Okay, that's not hard to understand. Witches are here. Right. We understand witches. Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, our right. world is in this. Okay, that's interesting. Oh, like doors between worlds. Okay, but then like this shadowy like church organization,
sort of church.
And then like that thing. And dust yeah. are like the two things that are really hard to land for people. Where they're like, "What right. is it?" And I'm like, "It depends who you ask." You know, honestly.
Yeah.
So that's the problem, I think.
Give me James McAvoy explaining it in that glorious, rich chocolate cake accent any any day.
It
that like
is
collegiate
it's like ganache,
right?
Chocolate ganache.
Right?
That accent, I know.
He just like he sinks yeah. into it. He yeah. leans into it. He sinks yeah. into it. That like I'm wearing a collegiate sweater and yeah. I've got my legs crossed, leaning against the table. I am every cliche, and it mm-hmm. some and it also works.
Oh
you know?
Yeah, I love it. His opening speech to the scholars I thought was actually one of the series highlights, where he says, "You think he's about to say who will stand with me," and he says, "Who will stand against me?"
It's so good.
It's just brilliant.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah.
And again, like, give Jack Thorne that. There are some moments of script writing in this that are great and
yeah.
crystalline yeah. and a little twist on what you expect and like efficient, and then I think it just sort of got a little clunky near the end.
And then I do yeah. want to say I think it looks beautiful. Like
yeah.
this is
yeah.
a beautiful, beautiful show. Like all the stuff at the end and the snow with the northern lights, and like I think the bears look great, and like armor issues aside, like they just
right.
mm-hmm. they feel heavy, which is so hard mm-hmm. to do. I believe that they're real. I believe that like the scene with Yorick and Lyra when they're like eating in the snow and just sort of like taking a beat before their
yeah.
next like step of their journey. I loved that part, and that felt like a real bear talking to a girl.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this right. is good. This is
that was
this
good.
Is the high fantasy TV shit you want. So
yeah,
right.
yeah. And when they say goodbye, I feel like it even almost made up for some of the stuff that I was missing. When they say goodbye, it was really resonant and warm and all the things about their relationship. Yeah. Okay. We haven't talked about the bear fight. Oh, man.
I hated it.
Will hated it.
But we don't need that to be the final word on it. End of podcast.
Better than movie. He was at least named Jofur Ragnarsson. That's a start.
Sure.
Acting was great. I thought he looked great. They didn't quite sell the whole it's a fight to the death that's incredibly important. There were pieces of it that were just like, what? Wait, what? Why? What? Huh? Like, there are 200 bears here, but he's going to walk unchallenged as of yet because he doesn't know the deal, unchallenged into this core sanctum of the place. Or, you know, okay, the big over, there are two things. One is the taking off armor for the fight, which I don't get at all. I get from a VFX budget standpoint.
Sure.
Other than that, I don't get it.
I hate it. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Hate yeah. it. Thanks.
Yep.
I hate it.
Uh-huh.
the other thing is that they never set up at all why Jofur Ragnarsson was a bad king, and they never set up that Yorick was tricked.
Yeah.
So now you have no reason to think he's not a good king. They're like, they're following him. It seems like this is nothing's going wrong. They don't explain why they're against everything's against their nature.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, if you take the series alone, Yorick is the usurper, because all you know in the series is that he was defeated in battle, which should rightly remove him from the throne. You
yeah.
don't know that he was tricked. It's like it's hinted. Mrs. Coulter kind of talks about it, but it's never quite made clear that he was a rightful king usurped.
Yeah. yeah.
All he was defeated in battle. Then he barrels in, tricks his way into another fight and wins that fight. And so technically he's sort of the tricker.
Right.
And that's not Yorick.
And then
you know?
He like leads his bears into getting like shot up. So
yeah.
No, I think I agree with all of that. Yeah. What do you make of Lyra? And I think this is something that is super important that the movie missed very much so. Which is Lyra as a liar, as a good liar.
Yeah.
Like what do you think of Daphne or the script in trying to convey that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it did a little in the movie, in the opening of the movie. She's telling tall tales.
But yeah, but they kind of dropped the thread. I did like in the series that they do try to develop it, where we see Lyra like lying to some people. But then when she first goes to live with Mrs. Coulter, She at first believes Mrs. Coulter, and then she sees through her lies, but she is not herself able to lie to Mrs. Coulter. And then we see her throughout the series, like, actively working on this skill to the, when you get to the scene where she is, after she got taken out of the machine and she's lying there with Mrs. Coulter,
right?
She actually is able to, like, overcome. And it's like a very traditional, like, the student becomes the master, right? And, like, you know, right, emerges as the true liar. So I actually really like that about it, that they took the time to develop that skill.
How do you feel about it?
I just always loved that about Lyra, because I love that she's not, like, a good girl necessarily. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, Will is the good boy, and she's, like, kind of, yeah, not. And so I like it when they do it. And so, like, that's one aspect of the bear fight that was both hit and miss for me, like, that you have her trying to, like, use her powers of deceit to, like, help Yorick. I don't think it's as successful as it is in the book, obviously, but I think you have it there. And I just think Daphne Keene is really good at it. I'm just really grateful that she has been cast in this role. I think she's a dream Lyra for me. So
I agree.
Yeah.
I wish the script would give her a little bit more of what they regrettably refer to as the savage Lyra. Like, you know, I wish there was a little bit more of the wildness of, I don't think that's Daphne. I think she can totally do it. I think it's, oh, yeah, there's, oh, yeah, not enough of that,
I
in
mean,
the script.
The Logan Lyra.
Baby Wolverine. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
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 So I hope, you know.
The scene after the bear fight in the books where she is, like, elbow deep, yeah, in blood, and she's, like, sewing up the bear, you know, and she's, yeah, like you could see sort of the child parts of her sort of getting, like, violently taken away. It's very Arya like. My sister is constantly texting me as she's starting to read the series and be like, oh, it's like Arya. This is so much like Arya, which, you know, isn't something that, for those of us who care about Lyra, the character, like, wish on her.
The thing, yeah, the Arya thing is interesting to me, because, like, Arya was such a successful character for so long on Game of Thrones for me, and then sort of not towards the end. I feel like they didn't really know where to go with her. But, like, what I love about her is that the success of that character, the popularity of that character, has made people interested in other messy young girl protagonists, you know what I mean? And that makes, yeah, me really happy. I mentioned the Alana books by Tamara Pierce earlier, and I'm like, those books were written before Game of Thrones and before Harry Potter, but I like to refer to them as now as, like, Arya Stark Goes to Hogwarts, because that's kind of what those books are. And that's, mm-hmm, like, that's a, like, everyone's like, oh, I would read that. I'm like, yeah, thank you, other franchises, for giving me an easy way to, like, sell this series to people.
What's the series again?
The Song of the Lioness Quartet is what the original four books are called. The first book is called Alana. It's about a young girl who wants to become a knight. So she disguises herself as a boy and goes to train at a castle. And it's, I mean, they're, like, very important books to me, and they've been optioned, mm-hmm, for a TV series, so I'm excited.
Oh, cool.
Well, I'm excited and apprehensive, you know, when something you really care,
yeah,
about,
yeah,
is, right, optioned, a la this series perhaps.
A la.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Can I shout out, like, some weird random characters that,
yes,
I really liked? I really like Sister Clara, who's played by this actress, Morfydd Clark, who,
yes,
I saw in this great horror movie, Saint Maud, which I saw it at Fantastic Fest, but I believe, oh, 824 is distributing it later this year. That's a horror movie about, like, religious mania. So when she shows, oh, up as, like, Sister Clara, I just think she does stuff with her face. She's so unsettling and great. And she's so good at being, like, quiet and demure, but also really scary and intense. And so, yes, she's just this, like, really interesting element that they found space for, I feel like, at Bullvanger. And she's rumored to be playing Galadriel in the Lord of the Rings TV show. So that's,
oh,
you know, something to keep your eye on. And then, since this is a Harry Potter,
yeah, yeah,
friendly,
yeah,
people, shout out to Harry Melling for,
yes,
his. I thought he was so good.
He was so good.
Yes,
so
he was
good. As what, Sisselman?
35 last year. Sorry, the episode after he showed up, I did that the entire the entire show.
Yeah.
I'm sure we lost listeners because I just kept yelling 35 last year. There were 36 or something.
We gained listeners.
It's so funny because we had like tweeted and said on the podcast and whatever about how Harry Melling was going to be in it and who he was playing. He was playing Sisselman, et cetera, et cetera. And then the week it aired, 4,000 articles about how Dudley is in,
right?
Yeah, he had a moment.
Sorry, I interrupted you, but
no, it was just funny for me. Like, maybe I knew that he was going to be in it. I definitely knew what Harry Melling looks like now because I had definitely done one of those things where you like stumble upon a like, oh my god, you won't believe what Dudley Dursley looks like now, sort of thing. He's neviled himself. Oh my god. So I knew what he looked like, but I was like watching the scene. I was like, oh my god, it's him. And then I like googled it. I was like, it is him. It's so great. And he's so good. And like, that's
so good.
That's the thing, is like, I'm so happy for him because he could have so easily been like, that was the one thing he ever did. But I was like, no, this kid's got talent. Mm-hmm. He can just like, doing other stuff.
He's been quietly doing theater since Harry Potter. Oh, he's been just sort of going about his life.
Cool.
Being in shows.
That's so cool.
Just sort of.
I'm really happy for him. I'm happy.
I'm so glad he's doing stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I thought that character was a great example of what the show is getting right.
Yeah.
In that he was so good as like the banality of evil.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
He was like, he wasn't necessarily a bad guy. He was just like a cog in a very bad machine.
Yeah.
Just kind of trying to stay under the radar.
They're in sort of the Deadwood of that world.
Oh, I like that.
You know,
they're
out in nowhere, a little bit beyond the law. The law's sort of there, but you're sort of forgotten by it too.
It's kind of subject to those who have power and money increasingly in that part of the world. And so I thought he was so good as that role.
Oh man, I'm blanking on her first name right now, but Sosanya, Nina Sosanya, the Elaine. I thought she was one of the
Will's
best
mom.
Actresses I've ever seen on screen. I thought she just, and also frankly the writing of her character, she's less symptomatic than she is in the book. She's less, has less of a severe diagnosis, and they do a lot of good things with mental illness, I thought, in this. They do a lot of like the fight to be heard, the fight to be understood, the how hard it is to stand up for yourself, and the fact that she does stand up for herself and her family is really, I don't know, I thought it was a special portrayal.
Worth, if we're going to go after Jack Thorne a little bit for some things, it's worth giving him credit where it's due. Anecdotally, Jack Thorne does post a lot about like disability and disability rights. Yeah, it seems to be, I don't know if that is like part of his personal life or not, but it seems to be a cause that he cares a lot about. So it was really cool to see that very like nuanced portrait in the series.
I think it's very sensitively done and very well done, but like slightly unbelievable that like, if she's showing up to Will's school to the point where Will's getting bullied about it, that like nobody is no one checking in on him for that. His like PE teacher is aware, but like not doing anything. So
The PE teacher is like taking her in, but nobody's calling the social services. But maybe that's a kindness. I'm not going to call social service or whatever the equivalent is.
Yeah.
What's your demon?
Like, well, I have a question for you. Like, when you think about your demon, is it different from your Patronus? Like,
yes.
Yes?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, how do you distinguish between the two?
Your Patronus is a representation of someone or something that protects you.
Mm.
And your demon is a representation of you yourself. So Harry's demon would probably not be a stag.
Got
Harry's demon, I don't know. I don't know what Harry's demon would be. Philip Pullman said a long time ago in some interview, and I've always taken it to heart, to have the two people closest to you choose your demon.
Oh my god.
Right? It's a really cool.
Okay.
Right?
Well, I'm going to text some people later about that, but
I said for you some sort of owl, but that was just like an off the cuff thought.
So
if you want to like
Oh, that's really I feel very honored by that. What's more true probably though is that I am some sort of indoor cat. You know, like not even really a very sprightly cat. Just sort of
well,
like
you could be like a Sophanax.
Like a Sophanax.
Yeah.
You could be a palace cat. I love palace cats. They're the little angry face?
Yeah. That's me, angry face, little angry face. But I love
it. It's not that one. You don't look angry at
and,
all.
No. And Owl, I feel like oddly touched and honored that you said that. Aww. What a like fun thing to like tell people what you think their demon is. What have you guys said about each other or yourselves?
Before Will finished book one, he was like, I think maybe I have a Pine Marten demon. And I was like, interesting. Yeah. And I just sort of couldn't say anything else about his demon because I didn't want to like agree, because I do think that is a very high contender for a demon for you.
Yeah.
And for
6 months later, I was like, well, shit. Yeah. I can't say that anymore.
Well, I mean, you hadn't read it yet. You didn't know.
I had.
You know?
Yeah. We have audio proof.
People have been like DMing us like, wait, is he really? And he would say things on the podcast like he was like done with book one and he was like, I don't know, it seems like Larry's gonna try and kill God. I'm like, God damn it.
I like, thought that you was know. Pretty clear. Yeah.
He does this. It's wild. Okay. So my friends told me a long time ago I had a lion demon. Then HBO sent me that crazy package. They sent me an otter.
And
I like the idea of an otter.
Oh, I need to think about that demon. For you. I like it. I want to think about it though.
Yeah.
But I like it. Yeah. I'm not like wrong.
I think they had an easy time because my company's name is Mischief Management. So they were like, oh, Mischief, otters, done.
Oh, nice.
You know? So, So somewhere in between lion and otter. Maybe it's like a saber-toothed tiger or something.
Ooh.
Yeah.
So there, you know, Pottermore has the like Patronus thing, but I feel like the demon thing should be more like a, and probably online demon things exist
they
as well.
They have this thing that you do in your direct messages on Twitter, which is really strange.
I feel like it should be like a Myers-Briggs test to like pick your demon. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It should be a lengthy questionnaire.
Yes.
Lengthy.
Yes.
Lengthy. Yeah. Completely obnoxious. Yes. We'll design it.
Okay, great.
Let us know, HBO. We're on it. And then we every episode on Extraneous, we give somebody an extra award. And so if we're talking about a set of chapters, we say like in these chapters, you know, Kaisa couldn't stop giving us exposition, so Kaisa gets the extra award this week, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But when we have guests or when we're talking about the series as a whole, we start talking about the extra Hall of Fame. And this is somebody who will be in there forever. So once somebody's in, that's it.
Yeah.
They're like nobody else can choose it. So the people that we have awarded extra Hall of Fame's placement to are one, Lyra, because if you're going to do the extra Hall of Fame, she's the first one.
First ballot, anonymous.
Unanimous. Unanimous. The second slot was given by our last guest, Frack, to Sailor Jerry, because Sailor Jerry gives a very important statement. Mm-hmm. So we are offering an extra Hall of Fame slot for you two. It could be anybody. Who would you put in the extra? Who are you giving an esteemed slot in the extra Hall of Fame?
That's right.
Between the two, the gay angels, who's the bitchiest?
Baruch and Bathalmos.
Yeah,
which one is Bathalmos? Is the one
Bathalmos?
Bathalmos.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Extra Hall of Fame.
Yes, like, I love this.
So bitchy. A bitchy angel is how I feel about him, and I love him. So
angel with an arc. A bitchy angel with a hero's journey.
Yeah.
I love it.
That's my nominee for sure.
Fuck off, Asriel.
Fuck off, Asriel.
Wait your turn.
Fuck off, Father Gomez.
Yeah.
Yeah, fuck off, Asriel. You wait. He'll get
he's
there
not eventually. In yet.
Watch, he never gets it.
I know. I love it.
Because he's like the most extra of them all, and it's like, eh. You know. So what are some of the things that you're excited for Subtle Knife?
Chittagazi? I was like, I didn't know if we were like going to get it in the finale you know, like how quickly we're going to get there. But I'm like fascinated to see. Like,
wait, do you think, okay, yes or no, we'll walk through the same door as Boreal? And yes or no, does that make any sense to you?
I feel like they're going to use Boreal differently. Is what like would be my guess in terms of like the way in which they've amped him up, right? So,
but like Will goes through the same portal, so if that would be Will going into Lyra's world, whereas Will's supposed to go into Chitagatse. So how the hell
in the series? Yeah, he literally goes through the same. So the it's like a one of these fundamental like misses on the show if we're reading it, or maybe season two will come and we'll it'll make
it,
sense
or they don't explain it and they're just both in a weird
have we seen Boreal go I'm sure we probably have and I'm just missing it, but like have we seen Boreal go directly through from one to the other? Because I almost wonder,
like, not like 1 foot in, 1 foot out. You think they're going to explain it like he goes through like a way station? Lobby?
Yeah, sort of. Thing.
Yeah,
like a way station.
Yeah.
Like in Wreck-It Ralph when they have the lobby. Yeah.
Yeah. Like the good place.
Yeah. I don't know.
Maybe.
I don't know.
Sorry, I totally interrupted.
No, your
excitement.
And then I'm presuming that they chemistry test these two kids together. Mm-hmm. How could they not? But I'm really interested to see how they interact, because that's going to be it. That's going to be huge. Like if it works really, like, I like them individually so much, but that doesn't always mean that these two characters work well together.
Yep.
And I'm sure that the kid playing Will is, you know, basically an unknown, and not like Daphne Keene is the biggest star in the world, but she had done Logan. And so like she was a known quantity. So I'm assuming that they just like went ahead and tested every boy they could find against her to find like the one that sparked with her the best. And so I'm excited to see that.
I have high hopes. He's so good. I think he's one of the best natural talents I've seen in a little bit.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I'm excited. They're both really good eye actors. Yeah. And so it's gonna be real ferocious when they're together.
Yeah. How about you guys? What are you excited to see?
I'm also excited to see Chidagatse. I'm excited to see the knife.
Oh,
that's going to be a big one too. How is the knife going to work? It doesn't have to look like anything special, right? Because it doesn't necessarily in the book.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they're going to have to somehow convey like the power in it.
Yeah.
So I'm really looking forward to the scenes where Will starts to figure that out. I'm a sucker for like people coming into their power.
Finding their weapon, their like destiny, weapon of destiny sort of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The specters, I think, would be really interesting. Yes. And another like huge challenge. How do you show that on TV?
Yeah.
That being said, the like portal that poor Roger helped rip that they walked through, I thought that looked amazing.
It did.
Yes.
And I like it
with
better.
The little like tendrils of whatever ripped fabric of space-time sort of like you know, billowing in the wind. I thought it looked really cool.
I think I like it a little better than the book, which always seemed a little bit weird to me. So there's a bridge, you can walk into it, you can walk up into the sky, like I don't understand. This looks more like, okay, you just walk through. I'm real excited for John Perry, and I'm excited for Lee Scoresby's Last Stand.
Yes.
Quote-unquote Last Stand, but you know, the Alamo scene, you know, that's gonna be special.
I really like the Hester. I really like her
and their relationship. She's snarky, even if it made no sense that she wasn't fighting in the bar. It's fine. Oh, so much to talk about. I could do this. Okay, so Joanna, thank you so much for coming and hanging out with us. This is so exciting.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me. It was really fun to talk to you guys about it.
Well, we'll be around. We're committed.
Come back anytime.
Thank you.
So Joanna's great.
We love her so much.
Will has a crush.
I don't think it's a secret.
It's like you love Joanna.
I meant it sincerely when we talked about guests. My first thought was Joanna Robinson should come on the pod because Melissa knows her and she's so cool. I didn't even know she knew the HDM series at all. I suspect that she did. Because she's cool like that. But
yeah, before Will had even met me, he used to follow, or still does, but had already followed Joanna's work in Vanity Fair and stuff. And so she's just such a smart and amazing person. And we're so happy she came to visit us. Go listen to her pods. Follow her on Twitter. She's Joe Wrote This on Twitter. And yeah.
Yeah. Check out her My So-Called Life podcast.
Yeah. I have to rewatch My So-Called Life and just so that I can listen to the podcast, because I haven't watched My So-Called Life since it was in its initial incarnation. You didn't ever watch it. I'm looking at your face.
Nope,
there's nothing on your face right now.
Nope. I missed it by a couple years, I think.
He's younger than me.
Well, I mean.
What else is there to say?
What else is there to say?
Guys,
I'm nothing.
We're so excited to get back into Subtle Knife. We're so excited that Joanna was on the pod. We're excited for future guests. We cannot wait to get into this year. So
tell a friend. Please tell a friend that you have buddies on the podcast. And real soon, we're going to have a Mischief Media Patreon. And the Mischief Media Patreon with membership in it will get you into a Discord that we are starting up, where we can have these conversations literally all day. And that's exciting. So,
yeah.
So keep an eye out for that so that we can keep the conversation going.
In the meantime.
What does one do in the meantime, William?
In the meantime, in the new year, 2020, fresh start. Everything's new except for one thing, and that is that you should remain ever and always in perpetuity. I'm pointing at you.
I know you're pointing
at me.
This
is your moment.
But it's the phrase is not remain. Stay extra, y'all.
Stay extra.